Game On 2FM with Green Firm. Healthy snacking made easy with Green Firm's high protein on the go range. Available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide.
Thanks to you, Jenny Green. It's Thursday the 12th of November and this is Game On.
Coming up today, as we wait on Irish team news, Michael Owen joins us to talk Grealish, Gomez and goals like this.
This is Owen, taking in his stride. Chamot trying not to bring him down. It's still Michael Owen. He scored a wonderful goal. Is there nothing beyond this 18-year-old?
Greg Allen has the latest from the Masters, where Bryson DeChambeau has steadied the ship after some early mishaps.
You hear the speed of those practice swings? You could get caught up in a vortex there. This is all systems go, folks. Lift off at Augusta.
No.
That is way left also. That might be further left than John Rahm.
That sounds like me watching my own golf ball heading off down the fairway. But we'll also have Andy Moran on the Connacht final, Gavin Casey on Katie's big fight. And in racing, I think we'll have a look forward to Tiger Roll having a run in Cheltenham tomorrow, Marie.
Why not?
Game on 2FM.
Now you can text us on 51552 or tweet at Game On 2FM. We'll be chatting to Michael Owen about the Republic of Ireland and England game as well. And we are awaiting some team news. There was a little bit of team news earlier when it was announced that James McCarthy has left the Republic of Ireland squad ahead of the game. He needs to attend to a family matter, and the Republic are already without the services of Aaron Connolly, Enda Stevens and Callum Robinson. So it'll be very interesting to see what team is named. It'll be very interesting as well to see what Michael Owen thinks of Republic of Ireland football and what he has always thought of the Republic of Ireland's football team.
I guess when you're missing a few, it kind of makes team selection a bit easier, doesn't it?
Well, it depends who you're missing. I mean, you're still under the same pressure to go out and score goals and win matches, so...
Yeah, but when you have less to pick from, what do? You can only play with what you've got.
Throw them in.
Yeah, exactly. Best of luck, lads.
Yeah, we're talking about the pandemic all the time, and it was actually interesting listening to the news there and hearing them talking about who's coming home for Christmas or not coming home for Christmas. But there was a little bit of positive news today. We heard earlier that the European Cross Country Championships were cancelled, but the 2021 event will now take place in Dublin. So that's a bit of good news, because who knew what was going to happen with that. Ruby, just from a travel point of view, how is it affecting racing? Have you kind of adapted now to the way it is?
No, horses can go. Trainers haven't been going, travelling to the UK or wherever it may be. All right, some went to America, but at the quarantine when they came back. But even tomorrow, Marie, Tiger Roll goes to run in Cheltenham. I don't know if Gordon Elliott will go. He'd have to quarantine for a fortnight. He hardly will. But Robert Power rides him. Keith Donoghue can't go and ride Tiger Roll, who would have been riding him, because it's not a Grade 1 race. In racing, you can only travel and ride in the elite races, the Grade 1s, and there's no Grade 1 race meeting, Grade 1 race this weekend in Cheltenham, so none of the Irish jockeys are there. A lot of them would have been in Cheltenham tomorrow. Some would have stayed for Saturday. The majority would have been home all right for Sunday in Punchestown, but no, it's just the way it is. So Robert Power, who had to move to the UK to fulfil commitments for Colin Tizard, takes over on Tiger Roll, so that's a blow for Keith Donoghue.
And what about quality then of races? Does it still feel the same?
It does, I suppose, for the big races. It's early in the national hunt season, but even the whole meeting at Cheltenham this weekend, it would have had a much larger Irish involvement had there been A, attendances, B, if owners could go and travel was free. It would have been, this would be Cheltenham's second biggest meeting of the year. You'd have crowds upwards on 30, you'd have 30,000 probably tomorrow and 40 on Saturday and Sunday, and a lot of Irish people would have went, but there's nobody going, nobody can go, there's no crowds, and owners probably aren't willing to send horses they can't go and watch. So yeah, of course it's making it less competitive in England and slightly less competitive in Ireland with no English horses coming, but with the standard of racing here at the minute, the English haven't been coming to take us on anyway. They've been rather stay at home, and it's a lot easier to lose in Newbury than it is come to Ireland and lose.
That's a very good point. Now, well, the Master doesn't really look the same anyway, because it was lashing down rain earlier on and play was suspended, but it is back underway and Greg Allen has been watching it very closely for us and he joins us now. Greg, what is the latest?
Well, the latest is that the scoring is extremely good, and that's partly because of all that rain that fell. When you get 3 hours of rain, and pretty biblical type of rain as well, that they had to create the near 3 hour suspension of play, you get very soft conditions, and good players love soft conditions. They also love calm conditions, and that's what they've got. And it's also pretty warm, about 25 degrees, 26 degrees, mid-70s as they go by Fahrenheit in America. So the top of the leaderboard sees Lee Westwood, 47-year-old Lee Westwood, who has a sneaky, very, very good record around Augusta. In the last eight Masters that he's played, he's been top 10 five times and runner-up twice and third one out of the other times. So he's the joint leader on five under par, a beautiful front nine. And remember, they're playing on starting on both nines. It's a very unusual scenario for the Masters. They normally all tee off the first, but because of the diminished amount of light that you have in November, they tee off the first, and another group tee off the 10th. So Westwood actually teed off on the front nine, which is regarded as being the tougher of the two nines. So five under after 10 now, Lee Westwood, tied for the lead with Webb Simpson, the 2012 US Open champion, the world's top 10 player now for pretty much most of the last year. Very consistent player, Webb Simpson. Doesn't hit it very far, but is very accurate, and with that arm lock putting style that he has, also a very, very good putter. And Webb Simpson is five under after 11, so Webb Simpson and Lee Westwood tied for the lead, one stroke clear of Louis Westhuizen, who's four under after 10. He was a runner-up to Bubba back in 2012. Paul Casey, four under after 9. Patrick Reed, three under after 9, the champion 2 years ago. Tiger Woods, three under after 8. And looking very composed, looking as though there has been nothing to indicate the poor form that he's shown this season. He hasn't had a better than a top 30 finish since January. And here he is, three birdies in the first eight holes. And he started off on the 10th, by the way. So he birdied the 13th and the 15th, those back nine par fives, and then almost had a hole in one on the 16th, tapped in from a foot there. So Woods really in a beautiful early rhythm. Don't often see that in the Masters from him, because he doesn't often start all that well. But Woods, three under after eight, just two off the lead, tied for fifth. Hideki Matsuyama, one of the better ball strikers in the world, he's two under after 11. Scottie Scheffler, runner-up in the USPGA Championship, he's two under after 10. Henrik Stenson, the Open champion in 2017, two under after 9. Mike Weir, the former Masters champion from 17 years ago, two under after 7. And Rafa Cabrera-Bello from Spain, two under after 6. So that completes the top 10. And just looking at other players just bubbling outside the top 10, John Rahm, after a very bad start, two bogeys early on, but he's made three birdies since then, one of them on the 18th, which was his ninth hole from just 6 feet. And Rahm is well into his rhythm now, one under after 10. And we haven't yet mentioned the great favourite, the man about whom a great deal has been spoken, hitting the ball out of sight in the practice days, Bryson DeChambeau. His first drive was 40 yards left of the target line and into trees. His second drive was also into trees, and that was a provisional ball. He found the first one. And his third drive into the trees on the 13th, with the driver that is, was actually so far, he was in the trees, but he was so far in bushes from his second shot that he ended up taking a double bogey 7. So Bryson DeChambeau has got those two dropped shots back, though, the double bogey on 13 with a couple of birdies before the turn. So he's back to level par after 10. So he's okay. He's inside the top 20 and he's 5 off the lead, but it's early stages yet. So Bryson DeChambeau, a wobbly start, but he's okay. Now, speaking of wobbly starts, Shane Lowry, 2 over after 7. Just hasn't really settled at all. A great drive down the 10th, his first hole, 322 yards. But since then, it's been all fairly ropey. Bogeys on the 11th and the 14th. No birdies in the two par fives, the 13th or the 15th. So after seven holes, playing the back nine first, Shane Lowry is two over. And Graham McDowell, two over after six holes, also on the back nine. And that's the picture so far. Surprise, I suppose, at the top of the leaderboard. Westwood and Simpson, the leaders by one on five under.
Thanks a million, Greg. We'll get back to you before the end of the show if we can. We'll take a quick break.
Game on 2FM.
Well, welcome back to Game On. Obviously, Ireland are playing England tonight at Wembley Stadium, an empty Wembley Stadium. But anyway, it will go on, the big duel, the big clash, Ireland versus England. It is a friendly. And I suppose the usual lines get trotted out. Is there any such thing? And I know for most Irish people, when you're playing England, there probably isn't. But I wonder, is a view the other way from the English side? And joining us on the line now is former England international and prolific goal scorer for them, Michael Owen. Michael, how are you?
Good evening, Ruby. I'm fine, thank you.
Good, good, good. England, Ireland, Michael, does it mean as much to an English player as it does an Irish one?
It's quite hard to... I guess it is. It's quite hard to compare, really, because I'm not quite sure exactly how you feel towards those guys. But no, I mean, as soon as you play any sport, you know, you're always competitive. I think there's a good rivalry. Personally, I mean, I've got no huge rivalry personally towards any of the home nations, in, you know, for that matter, Ireland, Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales. I've I've got a lot of good friends from all over those different places. But of course, as soon as you put your national team shirt on, you know, the pride starts coursing through your veins, and you want to win. And if it's against a team that, you know a few of their players, they're almost next door neighbours type of thing, then of course it spices it up a little bit.
I think it's fair to say, Michael, that for a lot of people, some of their greatest ever sporting memories are when Ireland beat England at football, like in Euro 88 and Italian 90. It was such a big deal for everyone. I think the way that we see it is it's like the old enemy, and it's hard to even see a friendly being a friendly because it feels like there's so much more to it. But this time around, I'm actually not really sure. I don't know if it's because the build-up has been so low-key because there are so much other sports going on at the moment as well, and because there's going to be no fans there.
Yeah, no, of course, there is a rivalry, don't get me wrong, but off the pitch, you know, I've played alongside loads of Irish lads and you know, you see them as one of your own in a way, I think. I mean, that might not be a music to you guys' ears in a way, but I mean, you know, I think a lot of people, with all due respect, you know, Scottish, Welsh, they all want to beat England. I think it's England have been reasonably successful over a little bit of time, and you know, I think being the underdogs as well is it's come on, let's puff our chest out and beat England. And I think, you know, they're very proud people. Irish people are very proud people. So are some of the other nations that I've mentioned, and there's a lot of pride at stake. So I think, you know, I think it's a big game tonight. Of course, it's bragging rights, and there's other things in the future to think of. You know, it's another preparation game, but you know, there's not too many of them nowadays with all the Premier League being squeezed and things like that into it to getting everything completed. So, I mean, it's a big game for a number of different reasons. But you know, put it this way, I'm not watching it tonight thinking, "Oh, we've got to beat these Irish." You know, I just, you know, it's a nice game. You want to win it, but as far as I'm concerned, it's more of a friendly rivalry.
Well, I think the fact that Declan Rice and Jack Grealish are there as well, it probably adds to it in a way, and there will be a lot of people here watching it, Michael, going, we'd really like to get one over on the two of them because they didn't come and play for us.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing. I mean, and it's been quite interesting for some time now. Any player that's emerging, then, you know, all the different nations, whether, you know, whoever you are, everybody's looking at, right, is there any way, shape or form that we can get those these different players on our books and into the national team setup? And people are doing it, you know, federations are doing it earlier and earlier now. I mean, Wales capped, I think it was Harry Wilson when he was a real young kid. Now, you know, a lot of people were surprised at that at such a young age, but course, you know, to tie players down and to give them that prospect of being an international player so early, it's very hard to turn down. So I think a lot of players are seeing, as soon as a youngster comes through the ranks, you think, right, can we get hold of him? Has he got a father, a grandfather, a grandmother or whatever it might be? So it's always been like that, and I'm sure you know, it'll continue to be like that.
Michael, when you've watched when you've watched Jack Grealish playing for Aston Villa, has it surprised you how slow Gareth Southgate has been to play him and involve him in the English setup?
Do you know what it is? Yeah, and I've liked Grealish for a long, long time, and I've been so surprised that it's taken a long while to put him in, for one. And then, I mean, I would be building a team around him, but he would be one of the main players, and not just, you know, put him in the squad and give him 10 minutes. I mean, he would be a starter for me if I was the England manager. Now, Gareth's got his own ideas, I'm sure, and I'm sure the team will chop and change a lot between now and major tournaments. But, I mean, he can do stuff with a ball, without a ball, with a ball. He works hard off the ball as well, which surprises a few people, but he does. I mean, he can run with a ball. He's quick. He's got a skill. He can score goals. I mean, I think he's top notch, and I was surprised no one came in for him big time in the summer, because I think Aston Villa were expecting it. And I'm surprised that Gareth Southgate doesn't use him more than he does now. You know, that might change in the future, but yeah, so far I have been surprised.
A lot of people seem to echo what you say about Grealish. It's quite common for people to sing his praises, but then you have to wonder, why isn't he getting into that team?
Well, it's probably one area that I don't think we're at our strongest, you know. And I know he's not a central midfield player, but I think we're reasonably low on numbers in that type of area. Now, going forward, if he's playing a bit further forward, then we're quite well off, you know, with the Sterlings and the Canes and the attacking players, we're okay for. But if you're going to play a couple of sitting midfield players and one in behind, or if you're going to play one sitting midfield player and play two in front, then, you know, I would give him a run at that, especially against teams that you think you're going to have most of the ball against. I think that you can be a little bit more aggressive and play some of the more flair players. So, I mean, he's something very different to what we've got. I know people, when he first came on the scene, were saying he's the closest thing to Gazza that we've seen in a while. And I do see why people say that. Don't get me wrong, there's different attributes as well, but the way he runs with the ball, he's very quick as he's running. You know, he's strong, he's a brilliant shape as a player, and he two good feet. And I mean, I really like him. I've liked him for a long time. And a lot of people say as well, Maddison or Grealish, that was the sort of argument 1 or 2 years. I was always on the Grealish side of things. Maddison was getting more of a look in. But that's how it's been, and I've been quite surprised by that.
When you look at this English squad, do you think it has the star names that maybe you played with and we would associate with general English teams?
Say that again, Ruby, sorry.
When you look at this English squad, do you think it has the star names that you would have played with? Beckham, Scholes, no. Lampard, all of those names that we were so used to watching. Do you think there's that same amount of players here?
I don't, if I'm honest. I mean, the last thing you want to do is make a headline and say, oh, he's saying, you know, this team's not as good as all the rest of it, because it's not really what I'm saying. But no, I mean, for the players that we had, I think that was it was called the Golden Generation by a lot of people. I think we'll struggle for a number of years to have that, you know, have that group of players. And, you know, people can argue and say, well, was it that good? You didn't win anything. But not many teams win anything. You get a chance in the World Cup every 4 years. I mean, you can be successful in the Premier League, let's say. You're playing for two cups, you're playing for a European thing, you're playing in the league. You've got four chances of being successful every year. This is one every 4 years. I mean, it's nigh on impossible to be successful at international level. But for the players we had, no question about it, we should have gone further. And, you know, we've all got our own reasons for that, for thinking that. But, no, I mean, we had the most unbelievable squad. I mean, unbelievable. We've got no one like Gerrard, no one like Lampard, no one like Scholes, you know, the Beckhams are this. We're just talking midfielders alone here before you look at other parts of the pitch. I mean, probably goalkeeper was one area that we were reasonably weak over the years, and I'd say left midfield as well. We never had sort of a standout player that constantly played out on the left, but in terms of defenders, I mean, we had the best left-back in the world at the time, and Ashley Cole. We had Rio and Sol and John Terry, and, I mean, countless players at centre-half. Yeah, I mean, we had some team. Yeah, I don't think this would have the names of that. But in saying that, I think this team has probably got a better manager than we had in the, you know, in our stronger years, let's say. And I think this has got a great team spirit as well. I think they're onto something, you know, in terms of the camaraderie. But in terms of individual players, I would say not.
Why would you say he's a better manager than the one you had?
Well, I mean, I've always been a big believer, not in terms of the system, but I think England, if you look at England over the years, we've been very good with playing a back three. And I think it's always suited our players. You go back to some of the names I had. We used to stick Paul Scholes out on the left wing and things like that because we were adamant of playing 4-4-2. And we never had a left midfielder. You know, we were weak in certain areas. We were very, very strong at centre-half, so why don't you play three of them? We were dead strong centre-midfield. Why don't you play Scholes, Gerrard and Lampard? Because everyone said, oh, you can't play two of them. They don't work together. So you go back to when I was a kid, it was Euro 96, Vanderbilt's back, you know, 3-5-2, successful. Glenn Hoddle, 3-5-2 in the World Cup. We had an unbelievable team and circumstances went against us. We then go to a 4 under Sven and a 4 again under Capello. And it was just sort of certain players playing in positions that they've never, ever been, used to, and it also coincided with a time when Spain were the top dogs at the time, and they just had a number of midfield players. They hardly played with a striker, and they would just flood midfield areas and almost dictate the ball. And here's sorry old England playing 4-4-2. You know, we're getting swamped, totally swamped all the time for possession. Yet we had ball playing players. So I just thought at the time, and then again, the last World Cup we get to the semi-finals, what formation were we playing? Same again, 3-5-2. So all our success over the last 20, 30 years has been with a formation that I think suits the players that we've had. And when we've underperformed, it's been in the old rigid 4-4-2 that we've that sort of went out of fashion a long time ago. So I know that's how I see. I think if we had played a 3-5-2 when we had all those great players, I think we would have gone further.
Michael, it sounds like you spent a lot of time thinking about that.
I wrote a book a couple of years ago, so I was sat there for hours on end every day thinking about
if only.
Exactly.
Speaking of if only, poor Joe Gomez, a serious injury during England training, and whatever about missing the England games, which is obviously very, very difficult for him, but his season with Liverpool as well, also in jeopardy. Just a tough time for him, Michael.
Tough time for him. He's had, you know, a bad knee injury before. He's suffered from injuries before, but he's had a nice run of it in recent season or two and done particularly well. I mean, that back four and obviously with the goalkeeper as well has almost transformed Liverpool's fortunes. They were always scoring goals before then, but the introduction of Van Dijk and of course Alisson, and then it just upped the level of everybody else around them and that back four. So major blow, absolute major blow for Liverpool, of course. We're not quite sure yet. I mean, it's been reported that it's a tendon problem, so you know, ligaments, tendons, they're not great things to injure. As Ruby will know, they poor blood supply to that type of part of the body, so it normally takes a bit of time. So we'll find out the exact details, I'm sure, in the coming days and weeks. But no, it's a sickening blow for the lad and for the teams he represents.
It's always, I don't know, interesting or strange to think about it, but like how quick a bone heals over a ligament. Break your leg and it heals quicker than doing your cruciate. It amazes
me. Maybe it sounds
me.
Like you spent a lot of time thinking about that one now as well.
I did. The worst injury I ever had was dislocating my shoulder. It did reattach ligaments. It took months longer than any bone I ever broke. It's amazing how slow ligaments are.
Yeah,
you know all about them,
Michael. I think we can speak from a quite a good position here, Ruby, me and you, having suffered quite a number of injuries. But it's exactly the same in foot. People think a muscle injury is, you know, is, oh, that's all right, that's only a few weeks or whatever. But there, certain injuries that people think nothing of are the ones that actually do you in the long run. You know, they rob you of your speed and it's hard to get back from. The actual clean breaks, you know, okay, it means you're out for 6 weeks here or that, but you come back as right as rain. But the muscle injuries, I mean, you can just feel it. Every single one you have, it's slowing you down And as I say, it sounds really bad, but I mean, I prefer to fracture my leg than have a big tear in my muscle any day of the week. It's you tend to come back a lot easier from then than other injuries that people don't associate with being big ones.
And I'd say Jurgen Klopp would prefer it nearly if one of his players was having a break instead of a ligament injury. He's going to be struggling now for his defenders. But just for the other teams in the league, are they thinking, OK, maybe the Man City's and Liverpool's, it's not going to be a two-horse race anymore?
I think they will, yeah. I think they'll be thinking that. Definitely they'll be thinking, come on, if we can get to, you know, early 80s, if they can get the points total into the early 80s, then you might have a sniff this year. Of course, Man City and Liverpool have been getting big, big points, around the 100 points in the last sort of 3 years or whatever. But I think now, anyone that gets to 90 will, I'm pretty much, be a certainty for the league. So yeah, so the Chelsea's, the Tottenham's, maybe not Arsenal's, but maybe Manchester United's of this world. But in particular, I'd say Chelsea and Tottenham will be looking at thinking, we can get early 80s and that might give us a bit of a fight at the end.
I'd say it's a pretty big maybe now Manchester United are going to get there. Right, Man United fan.
He's humouring.
Even Edison Cavani's not going to get us to 80 odd points the way we're going.
It's top star, isn't it? You think, oh, they're onto something here, Manchester United, they're playing well, and then all of a sudden just like one step forward, two steps back. And I mean, it's yeah, they've got so many talented players that aren't producing. 1 week, as I say, they'll go and put five past someone in Europe, and you think, wow, that's it, they've got the right formula, and then they go and lose the next week. It's just it's a crazy situation at the minute at United. But you know, everyone has these periods of time where you've got to make hay while you've got the players, the manager, everything comes together at once, and that's where Liverpool are at the moment. Manchester City have been there over the last few years, and of course everyone knows that it's been a quiet time for Manchester United. But we also, everyone knows that in time they will come back and they'll have their cycle again. It's just a matter of when.
Michael, there's a text in for you. Do you think if you had Big Sam or Harry Redknapp as manager, you would have won a trophy with England?
I mean, Harry Redknapp was you know, an exceptional manager. Everyone played well under him. He could get the best out of players. I mean, my big regret was Glenn Hoddle not staying on. I mean, I think he's probably the best coach, or one of the best England coaches we've ever had. Even now, I work with him at BT Sport, and I mean, he's just a total encyclopedia of knowledge on football. He says things that nobody sees. And it was just such a shame that he left his job, because I think he would have, if he had stayed on and had that next golden generation that we spoke about earlier, I'm pretty certain that we would have done something.
So back to tonight then, Michael, what's your prediction? What are England going to beat Ireland by?
It's a bit of a negative question for you, Ruby. Ireland are always tough, aren't they? I mean, when I watch them, I'm always thinking it's going to be a 1-0, a 2-0, a 2-1. You know, they're very hard to beat. They've always lacked a load of flair and scoring lots of goals. But, you know, they've got that team spirit. They've got that passion. They've got those players that would do anything for the shirt. You hear all the stories of back in the day, the Jack Charlton years and things like that, and how much the players used to love meeting up. And it's quite the contrary to what other countries have, really. Sometimes it's a chore, because, you know, back in the day, the press were horrific, really, towards the England team. It was, you know, you felt as if you couldn't move. You're locked up in hotels, security everywhere. It was sometimes not a nice experience, and it was almost nice to get back to your clubs. Whereas all the lads at Ireland, or all the Irish lads I play with, just can't wait for international duty and get with the lads. And so I think they've always had that team spirit. But of course, I'm going to fancy England tonight. I'll probably go for a 1-0 or something like that to England.
1-0, we'll hope. 1-1 would really suit us. Michael Owen, thanks a million for taking our call. It was a pleasure to talk to you again.
Thanks so much, Michael. I better correct myself as well. I said that Ireland beat England in Italia 90, but it was 1-1, but it felt like a win.
It was as good as a win, Marie.
It was. Okay, we take a break and back then with Andy Moran and Gaelic football.
FM. Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Healthy snacking made easy with Green Firm's high protein on the go range. Available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now on Sunday, Galway will take on Mayo in this year's Connacht Senior Football Championship final in Pearse Stadium, with the place in the All-Ireland semi-final at stake. And it also means that one of these contenders for Sam Maguire will be gone. To look ahead to this game, Andy Moran joins us now. Andy, how are you?
Hi, Marie. How are you, Ruby? How are you keeping?
Good, Andy. Yourself?
All good.
Good to hear. Andy, I don't think we can get into this game on Sunday without looking back to what happened between Galway and Mayo just over 4 weeks ago. Mayo were absolutely fantastic. They went on then and lost to Tyrone, but they carried a lot of that scoring form through every game, scoring 773 in the last 4 weeks. Are you surprised with how they carried that through?
No, absolutely not. I think the form that was shown by some players in the club championship, the young guys that we have coming through, the likes of Oisin Mullen and Tommy Conroy, kind of have lit up under 20 scene over the last couple of months and years, and did the same during the club scene during the first kind of lockdown and when we went back to the club. So yeah, listen, it's great to see the likes of Killian playing so well, Kevin McLaughlin coming back the last day doing well, and I think an important player for us the last day who really played really well in the first half with Dermot O'Connor. So, no, not surprised at all. Really good form a couple of weeks ago against Galway. Again, the second half against Tyrone, Leitrim was solid. And I thought the last day against Roscommon, they were just so efficient. It was brilliant to watch.
That inside line that you mentioned, Conroy O'Shea and O'Connor, and how settled they are. And then if you look at Galway, Andy, and they changed their whole full back line from that Mayo game to their outing against Dublin. How are they going to cope now, trying to get up to speed with those lads who have been playing week in, week out, and even who's going to play there?
Yeah, it's a big confusion in the setup. I think the last time I was on, which I thought the likes of Longford, I thought they'd struggle against Louth because they'd missed a game. They'd go and beat Louth. And I thought the Cork game, when they missed that game against Longford, I thought that loss of Kerry playing Donegal and them not having a game, they'd really struggle to get up to the pace. But this doesn't seem to be proven the way. It seems to be there's a battle between do we want match practice or do we want freshness? And that really comes to the fore on Sunday. And which one has got to come to the front of it. Like, if you look at Galway, it's not like Galway haven't played. They played them two league games, played really poorly against Mayo. But then when they got their players back, when they got the likes of Sean Kelly, Mulkern, Liam Silk, all these boys back into the team, Shane Walsh, Paul Conroy, they played really, really well against Dublin. And the key thing to watch from that Dublin game, it was 12-8 after about 45 minutes in that game against Dublin in Galway, and Galway were leading 12-8, and then Dublin got 1-2, and then in the last minute of the game, the last play of the game, really, it's 1-15 to Dublin, 15 points to Galway. The game is so tight. Galway tried to press the kick out, and then all of a sudden Dublin catches them on the counter and they scored the second goal. So it ended 2-15 to 15, but the game was a lot tighter than that. I suppose the score, there's a different tale to that game, really.
Andy, my recollection of last Sunday's game between Mayo and Roscommon was Mayo burst out of the blocks, had the game pretty much won, and then it was like James Horne had his eye on next weekend and they just ticked over. Is he managing that freshness and that game management? He looks to be doing it to me.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Ruby. I thought he was really smart last week in the way he kind of used his team and the guys that aren't performing, I suppose, to the ultimate level. It's nice when you're 5-6 points up to be able to pull them off, bench them for 20 minutes just to show them that, hey, listen, there's guys here on the bench willing to come in and ready to come in to take your place. And also, it gives them guys that game time just on the pitch. So when required next Sunday or in All-Ireland semi-final or in All-Ireland final down the line, that these guys be ready to play. So it's really, really good management by James. I think another positive to come out of last week was the running that came out of the team. The Lee Keegans, the Paddy Durkins, the Stephen Cohns, the Owen McLaughlin, the amount of track they covered. And I agree with you. I think James has worked the freshness so far to this point really, really well.
Paddy Durkin, you mentioned him there, and like another player who's really excelling. 1-5 so far, but then if you look at him last week, 2 unreal scores from wing back, and he kept Enda Smith scoreless as well. So like a double threat, and it can leave Keegan back in the full back line as well if he needs to tag anyone.
Yeah, Kyle Craig did a lot of damage against us last year, Marie, in McHale Park. He scored a wonderful goal where he bet one or two of us and put it into the top corner. And Lee just went in and just really nullified the threat of Craig, which was brilliant. And then Paddy on the other side of it has done this, did this last year to Shane Walsh down in Limerick. Went on Ryan McHugh, actually went to wing forward against Donegal in McHale Park, went on Ryan McHugh, did a great job on Ryan McHugh, and then did the same to Jack McCaffrey against Dublin. But it was a great tussle between himself and Jack Mack up in Croker in the semi-final. So he has done this before for us in the past, where he's influenced the game himself while also taking a real danger man out of the game. And it's like his pace and his power is sensational. And one of the key tussles on Sunday, one of the ones to watch, if the weather allows us, is going to be Paddy Durkin v Shane Walsh on Sunday. I think it's going to be, it's definitely a battle that gets your mouth watering to kind of just look at the two boys in their full fitness going on one another in Pearce Stadium next week. Is going to be a great battle.
And who will pick up Conroy then?
See, this is the big battle. Who's going to do it? Is it going to be Lee? I would argue that, you know, they have a few options there. I was very impressed with Paul Kelly. But as you said, Conroy was the standout. And it depends if he plays at 6. Do you move Lee out then to mark him at 6? Or does he go inside? Does Shane Walsh play at 11 or does he play at 14? It all depends where they play. And if Shane Walsh goes to 14, does Paddy Durkin go back in to mark him? I would suggest yes. But you don't know. And then you move it like, Ruby, I don't know if you know Pier Stadium down there, but there's going to be a massive wind straight down the pitch. So do you allow Paddy Durkin to go into the full forward line, full back line to Mark Shane when they're with the wind or against the wind? Does that change at halftime? So that all comes into it as well. So who marks Conroy? I suggest Lee probably comes to centre back to mark him, and Paddy probably goes on Shane Walsh.
But that wind will blow the other wind. Well, it'll be for the other team in the second half or whichever half, and that'll surely suit Aidan O'Shea if he plays in the front line.
Exactly, and that's the other big tactic. The one we're all looking forward to is, like, personally, against the wind, I would definitely move Aidan out the middle of the field, because just to get him on more possession. But if you leave him in there, does he take attention off Killian, and does it help Killian get a few scores and Tommy Conroy to keep that goal-scoring form that he has at the minute? So it's a big one. With the wind, most certainly, in the edge of the square, you try to release the ball early to him, try to get him moving, and try to get just breaks off him and make him cause carnage in there. But against the wind, do you move him out? And they're all going to be the interesting battles on Sunday.
But against the wind then, with the new mark system, would you move him out between the 21 and 45 and see if he could get you a few marks from there?
Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion. The only problem with a mark, Ruby, would if you catch one 35 yards from goal and you're against the wind, that's a tough kick, you know. But yes, I would. I wouldn't mind if he played at 11 or if he played at 8 or 9 against the wind. But we'll see. Again, there is definite benefits of leaving them in there against the wind to just take the attention off everybody else. If Aidan is in there, if there's a sweeper in play, the one and a half man is always going to mark Aidan O'Shea. I used to love playing in beside him in corner forward, because you'd get a bit extra space when he's in there, you know, and he takes attention off you. So it's a tricky one. Me personally, same as yourself, I'd move him out maybe 20 yards or move him out fully to midfield. But he's a smart player, and I think he'll move a tiny bit on the pitch himself.
Do you think Joyce is going to go with Gary Sykes out of retirement? Look at the conditions. You know, he plays such good football at this time of year.
Played really well against Dublin when he came on. When I looked at the game first, I actually didn't recognise, like, it's not that I didn't recognise, he wasn't the person I was looking for, but when you look at it more closely, when he came on at half time against Dublin, he played really, really well linking the play. Do I think Joyce will play him? I don't think he will, just simply because the runners, like, Gary isn't too much younger than myself, the runners in terms of running up the field would be very difficult. But if Galway go against the wind first half and Gary Sykes is on that pitch, I think you'll see him with 20, 22, 25 minutes left. And you know yourself, coming in off that right wing, Marie, we've seen him many a time kicking with the left leg, that shot from distance is on. And here, the multiple of scorers, like the Paul Conroy's, really dominated the scoring for Galway against Dublin. Can they get the multiple scorers like the Finnerty's, the Shane Walsh, the Varley's, the Gary Sykes, the O'Donnell's? And on the other side, can we help Killian a bit more? Can Tommy now, you know, come up with 2 or 3 points? Aidan come up with 2 or 3 points? And Lee and Paddy Durkin come from the back for 2 or 3 points as well? And that's going to be, the, I think, the deciding factor in the game.
Call it so, Andy?
I think Mayo will win it, but I've called everything wrong this year, Marie, so we'll go with Mayo. I think 2 to 3 points, I think it's going to be a really tight game. I think the weather makes it so 50-50. I think Galway are a way better team than people think, because just in sport, when we're looking at stuff, we've really short memories, and we look now to have won a game since lockdown. But if you look at that Dublin game more closely, it's a really, really decent Galway team, and I think this is going to be a really tight game. But I suppose I'm going with my heart and I'm saying no by 2 or 3.
Thanks so much, Andy Moore, and we'll talk to you very, very soon about that and pull you up on those predictions. Enjoy it anyway. The Ireland team is in. They're starting 11. Randolph, Doherty, Shane Duffy, John Egan, Conor Hourihan, Alan Brown, Adam Ida, Cyrus Christie, Jeff Hendrick, Callum O'Dowda and Darrell Horgan. So Seamus Coleman and James McCarthy are out. We mentioned James at the top, and Seamus has been ruled out as well during injury, because of injury. The English team is in as well, and Grealish starts.
He does, with Calvin Loon and Sancho as well. Harry Maguire in the back four. Pope in goal, yeah, looks a good team, Marie. Michael Owen, 1-0 he said, did he?
Let's just leave it. Anything can happen in these games. Right, we're going to take a break. Next up, we're going to preview Katie Taylor's big fight with Gavin Casey, and he's also going to tell us exactly how the relationship with Carl Frampton and Barry McGuigan deteriorated.
With Green Farm, snack smart. With Green Farm's new high protein snacking range, available in selected Tesco, Super Value, and convenience stores nationwide.
Game on.
2FM.
Now, welcome back. We are going to talk about Katie Taylor's big fight very, very shortly. But first, there was a little bit of news today. Former world champion boxer Carl Frampton settled his multi-million pound legal battle with his former manager, Barry McGuigan. I think it's fair to say that it was quite the saga. 19 days of evidence. Gavin Casey joins us now. Gavin, how and why did it end up in court?
Yeah, I mean, 19 days in court, as you say, Marie, and I found it hard to believe when I was reading back over a couple of things earlier on that this saga began more than 3 years ago. I remember being at a Boxing Writers Association of America awards dinner in New York in March of 2017, I think it was, and Carl Frampton was about to be crowned the Boxing Writers Association of America's Fighter of the Year for that for the previous year, 2016. And his trainer, Shane McGuigan, was about to be crowned Trainer of the Year. And we were sitting a few tables behind them, and it just felt a bit weird. They weren't really talking to each other, and we were wondering, were they just tired, jet-lagged, etc.? And I remember talking to Carl afterwards after he had collected his award, and he didn't seem to be in great humour. We were asking him, would he stick around? I think Michael Conlon was making his pro debut the following night in New York, and they know each other very well. But Carl was saying, no, listen, I just want to go home. I just want to go home to my family. And he didn't stick around. And it wasn't long after that that this story kind of emerged publicly that there had been this massive falling out. I guess to answer your question as to how it wound up in court in 2017, Frampton broke from Cyclone Promotions, which is the promotional managerial company owned by the McGuigan family. He was contracted to them. He was listed for a long time as a director at that company, and they sued him for breach of contract. And that was in a London court, and he launched a countersuit in Belfast for basically loss of earnings, the withholding of earnings, accusing basically the McGuigans and Cyclone Promotions of withholding fight purses and not paying him the full amount that he was due for several fights in the preceding years.
And the announcement today that it was settled, that seemed to take a lot of people by surprise, and I had been following it, and when the news that there was 10,000 emails had been found after they had gone missing on servers, I thought it was going to be a lot more days of this, but it seems they settled it on the back of what was in these emails. Is that what happened?
Yeah, I suppose that hasn't been confirmed, but you'd have to imagine so. Based on the fact that these emails only turned up, I think it was 2 days ago, and as you say, there was a sense of anticipation that that might really extend this case and that it might go on for a lot longer than had been anticipated originally. And literally within 2 days, it settled. And Frampton seems to be, listen, like people who are listening in, I'm sure, realize that when a case is settled out, of course, there's usually one party happier than the other. And in this particular situation, it does appear as though Frampton is much the happier. In the McGuigan statement, they mentioned that they're satisfied as well and they're keen to move on, whereas Frampton has been quite jubilant, I think, all day, even on social media. And it would be, it would seem to be the case that those emails, which were basically emails that were on the Cyclone Promotions email accounts but had been deleted in 2017 and therefore presumed to have been lost, 10,000 of them, as you say, that were rediscovered, or somehow they were kind of tracked down from the bowels of the internet and the bowels of Gmail or whatever it was, and they were clearly extremely pertinent to this case. And on the back of those becoming available again, the case was settled fairly rapidly. So you'd imagine that those emails were absolutely crucial to that happening.
Simply amazing how one piece of evidence solved it all, really. Gavin, looking forward instead of looking backwards. Katie Taylor is in the ring this weekend against Miriam Gutierrez, who has won 13 of her fights, from 13 professional fights, 5 knockouts. Is Katie facing a big challenge, or is this a stepping stone towards a bout with Serrano?
I think it's a little bit of both, Ruby, to be honest with you. I like Taylor herself, it can almost sound like a cliche because she tends not to give much away in press conferences and interviews anyway, and she will always repeat the line that she's just focusing on this upcoming fight. But she's telling the truth when she says that. She has an almost robotic tunnel vision, narrow, like insular approach to each individual fight, and she won't be overlooking Gutierrez. I think on paper she has to be the heavy favourite, and is. But I mean, in terms of even doing an eye test on both of them, Gutierrez is a really slick boxer, very smooth, good footwork, good combinations, decent hand speed. Like, she's actually very fundamentally sound. But Taylor does the things that she does well twice or three times as well in nearly every department. And to be honest, the fact that Gutierrez is a kind of a pure boxer, similar to Taylor, probably plays into Taylor's hand stylistically. I think where we've seen Taylor put under the cosh in the past, it's been when Delphine Persoon, with her arms and elbows and incredible engine, pushed her to the pin of her collar. Whereas I don't really see that as being Gutierrez's style, or I don't see her being capable of doing that. So on the one hand, it's probably a stepping stone, but Taylor herself won't really view it that way. And on the other hand, that's not to dismiss Gutierrez's ability overall as a boxer. She probably beats most world-level opponents, but in Katie Taylor, she's fighting a generational talent, as we know, and I would anticipate that Taylor gets the job done probably inside the distance.
Why this fight, Gavin, do you think?
To be honest, Marie, on the back of that last Persoon rematch, which really doesn't feel like it was long ago, I think there was a sense that Taylor had a biblical run of fights, like on a par with anything any male boxer was doing. And I think the only other female boxer who had put together a run of high-level opponents to the same extent as Taylor had in the last couple of years was Jessica McCaskill, who previously pushed Taylor relatively close in London in 2017. So she was on this like kind of legendary run, really, of fighting world champion after world champion, dethroning them all, collecting all of the belts. She'd been in a couple of, probably three of her most grueling fights as a professional, in those two fights with Persoon and Christina Linardatu, in between that, up at 140 pounds. And not to suggest that Gutierrez was seen as a soft touch, but again, probably stylistically, it might not be quite so violent, this fight, and therefore you can kind of get away with sneaking it in before the end of the year. And what it does is it satisfies a mandatory challenge, basically, by Gutierrez. So she's the mandatory or number one challenger to Taylor's WBA title. And had Taylor, say, refused to take this fight or waited too long to take this fight, the WBA would make the case, arguably, that she should be relieved of that title. And if she's relieved of that WBA title, then somebody else picks it up in a vacant title fight. They become a world champion. And suddenly, even though Taylor hasn't lost her belt in the ring, her undisputed status is probably a little bit more disputed, in that suddenly you have another world champion within her division. So it's in Taylor's interest to hold on to all of those belts, and this probably felt like the optimal time to take this fight. And what that does is it keeps the WBA at least at bay, and she can seek fights that she wants to take herself early next year, next summer, and so on.
Well, hopefully it'll be enjoyable, because the last one was not at all. It was so hard to watch. My nerves were gone.
I loved it. It was brilliant.
It was too tense. A nice easy one now Saturday would be great. Gavin, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon. Ruby, is there a bit of racing this weekend?
There is. Cheltenham and Punchestown, Marie. Cheltenham tomorrow. Tiger Roll is back out. He runs in the cross Glen Farclough's cross country chase tomorrow, where he faces Easy's Dan, the horse who did defeat him at the Cheltenham Festival. And it's a handicap, Marie, so Tiger Roll is up against it, but he will no doubt give a good account of himself. Then you have the Paddy Power Gold Cup on Saturday. Mr. Fisher would be my fancy there to turn over the favourite St. Sonny. And on Sunday in Punchestown, you have the Morgiana Hurdle, where St. Roy will bid to put his champion hurdle credentials on the line. Great card in Punchestown on Saturday as well. A couple of rescheduled races that were lost from the Punchestown Festival. There's a good novice handicap chase. I think Willie Mullen sends 7 to post in that, full field of 20 runners. So great racing all weekend, right. Ireland and England.
You'll be busy, so. Will you get to watch the Masters?
I have it on here in the background. I'm still watching it. And at the minute, Marie, Paul Casey has gone to the lead. He's on 6 under par through 12 holes. He did miss a birdie on the 12th, or a putt for a birdie on the 12th. Webb Simpson is in second place. He is 5 under after 15. And there's a tie for third between Lily Westwood, John Rahm, Louis Oosthuizen and Tiger Woods. They're all on 4 under par. Only two Irish players on the course. Graham McDowell has picked up a shot. He's now on +1 after playing 9. And Shane Lowry is still on +2 after playing 11. Graham McDowell McDowell is in a tie for 32nd. Shane Lowry is in 36th. Rory McIlroy is due to tee off at 8 p.m. and James Sugrue is out 11 minutes later at 11 minutes past 8.
So who's your fancy? You never told me. Yesterday was it?
Who's
no, Tuesday.
My fancy? I would love to see Lee Westwood winning it. I think Zach Johnson has a chance. I think horses for courses, or golfers for golf courses even, I think Zach Johnson's iron play around Augusta is usually very, very good, and he's very accurate, so I would be siding with him at a huge price. But to be honest with you, I went and invested on the players that Gary Murphy told us last night, so I backed Dustin Johnson.
Very good. Well, we'll discuss it when you come back on Monday. That is all we have time for today. Tomorrow we'll return on the eve of what feels like one of the busiest weekends of sport ever. We'll be across the Masters with Greg Allen. We'll reflect on tonight's Ireland-England friendly. We'll continue our build-up to the Hurling and Football Championships, and then we're going to cross over as well to the Ireland-Wales rugby match. It is going to be absolutely crazy, but that is all we have time for now. Tara Stewart is up next. Bye for now.
Live across the nation, this is RTE 2FM.